Welcome on back to another episode of Culinary Road. I'm your host, Justin Melnick, alongside Fred Mullins. Fred, what's happening, man?
Hey, folks. How you doing? Good to see you again, Chef.
Yeah, always a pleasure to have you on here and to see you and to do this alongside you. So today we have a great friend of mine, actually one of my first friends at the Culinary Institute of America. So Sam Kennedy, who is he's a head cheesemaker at the farm at Dough Run, which is in Coatesville, Pennsylvania. But Sam we lived in the same dorm. He lived upstairs at the CIA, and he was one of the first people that I met. And yeah, Sam and I go back that far. So, you know, that's back in 2002 where we first met. And he's come quite some way in the culinary world, specifically cheese making. So we're talking today with Sam about the farm at Dough Run and St. Malachi and the St. Malachi Reserve that we were lucky enough to taste, and he sent it to us.
Delicious. And correct me if I'm wrong, it was voted one of the top cheeses of the world.
He's got a couple of awards with these ones. Yeah. And we'll get into that a little bit in the interview, but he has some regional awards, some United States awards, and also worldwide. There was one, the number one grass-fed cow's milk cheese in the world at one of the, I mean, number one in the world. I mean, how many cheeses are there? So
anyway, kind of saying something.
Yeah. Right. So besides, you know, obviously, like I said, Sam and I went to culinary school together, but we also, after a few years of recruiting, I got him to come down to the terrace of the Charlotte Inn when I was down on Martha's Vineyard. For the first year that we opened, Sam came down and became my sous chef, which was, you know, a great experience. And during that time, we were actually making some cheeses in-house that we were serving at the restaurant.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he was making some cheeses. He just, so before I sort of talked him out of the cheese world for a little while, he was the head cheesemaker at Cherry Grove Farm in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Enticed him to come over to the terrace of the Charlotte Inn for the first year we were open. And yeah, we had a great time, amazing time working with one of your best friends for sure. You know, he got that cheese bug and just couldn't, you know, I was trying to get him to make some cheeses, you know, at the restaurant and stuff, but it just wasn't the same. So he did a year at the terrace, and then he left to start at the farm at Dough Run, and he became the head cheesemaker there. And you know, things have just taken off. I've been buying his cheese when he was at Cherry Grove. I used to buy his cheese.
Well, he's been a staple on your menus for what now? Like, we're going on 10 plus years.
I mean, I used to buy his cheese when he was at Cherry Grove when I was at Tommaso.
I remember. Yeah, he had this great like soft cow's milk cheese, if I'm remembering correctly. And you're like, hey, this is my buddy Sam from culinary school, and I remember it being delicious, and it's like, God, go figure, you know, it's right. Just kind of crazy. Not that he couldn't do it, it's just, you know, you don't really think about culinary student becoming a cheesemaker, and then all of a sudden you went to school with him and there it is on the plate. It's kind of
right,
nice.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a lot of nostalgia there. You know, we had some fun times in, first of all,
in trenches together. Yeah,
right, in culinary school, and then we worked together at the terrace, and we did that for a year. And honestly, it's been, so we're sort of like 7 years, 8 years in between each time. So we went to school together and then took an 8 year break, and then we worked together and then took an 8 year break. And, you know,
it's like a once in a blue moon professional relationship, right?
Exactly.
Like at the cicada. I'm going to cut it in half, but yeah.
So this is actually the first time, I mean, we've been in touch and I've been buying his cheese and stuff like that, but this is the first time I've gotten the opportunity to sort of see him in person and talk about kind of our profession and, you know, things like that. So it was
going to be great. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Great catching up with Sam. But, you know, that got me thinking, and we talked a little bit before the interview about, you know, a little bit about nostalgia. Cause again, I'm talking about going back, you know, almost 20 years at this point, knowing Sam. And then Fred used to come down to the terrace, especially that first year. I was trying to put together a wine program and I needed all the help I can get. It's not what you know, it's who you know. And I was trying to get the who's down. And, you know, we've had some of those who's on the show already between Lorenzo and
Russell
and David and
David
Mitchell.
You've had some stars go through there.
I had to, and then I think you were probably the number one person that helped me the most. You know, you came down most frequently, and you know, I was able to lean on you a little bit more. And even after I was at the Terrace, even when I was in Ohio, I'd reach out. But you met Sam down there on the Vineyard as well. So, you know,
we all did a wine to get dinner together, right? You guys had only been he'd only been there for a couple of months at that point. I'm trying to remember, but like, it felt like it was a spring or maybe very early summer, because the season really didn't kick into high gear, like I think until around Memorial Day. But, you know, we would, you were like, hey, the staff would come in and like, hey, here's who I'm having present the wines this evening. It's going to be on the floor with you. But we would all sit around with the staff and taste the wine, kind of walk them through it so they knew what to expect, knew how to explain it, felt comfortable with it. And Sam, we were all sitting there and Sam was tasting it. And that was a producer, a tiny producer that we found in Northern Italy. And I just remember he had like this profound kind of moment, really, really connected with the wine, because the wine was, you know, beautiful, but a little unusual. And I think it just stuck with him. And you can just kind of see it on somebody's face. And I think those are those moments that you have that resonate with you and kind of carry you through. And I guarantee he must have had a moment like that with cheese, which is why he focused on cheese making. There's just something that happens and it clicks. And you'd like to say you know exactly why, but you don't. It just happens that way.
Right. It's those aha moments. And
yeah, a little bit.
You know, we were having our pre-interview chat, and you know, Sam mentioned this one wine, that wine you were just talking about, that kind of, he brought it up, and you know, it's a wine that I hadn't thought about for years and you hadn't thought about in years. And
you know,
it still sticks with him. One of those moments where you're just kind of like, oh, now I get it. Again, we keep using the word nostalgia, which kind of brings us to our top three. So
kinda
we have
like a segue in baking.
Bit of a segue. Yeah. So we have our segment where we do the top three, and you know, every week one of us picks the top three, and so top three whatever. And then this week was Fred's week to pick. So Fred, what you got?
Well, we're going to go with nostalgia. So here's what I'm throwing at you. And just to set up the rules for everybody, like there's really hard and fast rules, but if Justin picks picks what I was going to pick, I have to take that off my list. So we do a top three, but we might have 10 in the bank, just because there could be some crossover, and that's not what we want. But the subject this week is nostalgia. Your favorite childhood dishes, your favorite nostalgic dishes when you were growing up that your parents made, grandparents, maybe it was your neighbors, who knows, but those top three, because right? I've got quite a few, actually. I was kind of surprised at the list I had.
Right. Yeah. So
who else in your court, Chef? Ole. Right,
well, so we talked a little bit, one of these episodes about the reason I got into cooking was, you know, the culinary world in my house wasn't exactly.
Yeah, I kind of used that against you just now. That was
a little bit exactly top notch, but you know, there's still those moments that stick out, those aha kind of moments. And for me, the number one nostalgic moment that I have in my childhood is Christmas Eve making crispelli at my grandparents' house in the basement. So nice. There was two different kitchens. They had, you know, the top floor kitchen, and there was an apartment that was downstairs, and we used to go down there and make crispelli. So crispelli, this is a recipe from my grandmother's side, which was Italian. They're from Caserta in southern Italy.
Yep.
But it's basically a fried dough, and we would stuff it with either anchovies or mozzarella cheese. Sometimes we did like ricotta salata or whatever, but it was either cheese or anchovy. The anchovies are the ones you want. But for people who, you know, didn't eat fish.
Shame on them for not eating the anchovies. They were missing out.
But so the nostalgia part of it comes from my brothers and I and my uncles and, you know, whoever else, my aunt, you know, whoever else would venture down there. We would all go down there and we would make a batch of crispelli, which should take, and I know because I've made them many, many times since then, should take 20 minutes. Would take hours.
And the reason it would take so long,
we would all be down there drinking underage. So we would have Manhattans, which we'll get into in the episode with Sam as well. We would drink Manhattans or drinking beers or drinking whatever. But you know, we were all, you know, preteen or teenagers, depending on, you know, if it's myself or my brothers, or and we'd just be down there drinking, and you know, we'd make we'd make four, we'd eat three, put one in the basket. And, you know, it was just, and every year it was this tradition. So, you know, it happened the first year where we all just kind of, you know, we came upstairs hours later. We had,
you had like six Chris Belly in the basket.
Exactly. And then it became sort of a thing every year, but that was always, you know, it started that one year. And then, so to this day, every Christmas Eve, every Christmas Day, we always made them Christmas Eve, but I do both now. I used to serve them at restaurants, you know, that I worked at, on the terrace. We were open on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. That would be our bread choice of the day. But it all stems back to that, you know, Christmas Eve.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, drinking really Manhattans, which, you know, we'll get into that later on in the interview. Drinking beer and, you know, eating fried dough stuff with anchovy.
Right.
We'll do an Instagram Live one of these days.
We have to. That'd be a good one. A really good one.
Yeah. So that's my number one. Hands down, when you mentioned to me what the topic was, that was an easy choice for me.
That's a good one.
Chris Belly, hands down.
I'm impressed. I don't know if mine's going to sound as romantic as yours, but the first thing I can remember, and of course I'd eaten a bunch of meals before then, but I feel like I was like four or five. My mom makes the best chicken and dumplings.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's sort of, you want to call it a Southern dish, but it can be, you know, it's like an amalgam. It's like a pot pie without the crust on it. I was a little kid. I remember, I'm like, this tastes so good. And it's just, I can picture the kitchen, the avocado green kitchen appliances, because it was the 70s. I think I can remember the stupid itchy shirt I was wearing because everything was made out of polyester. I remember my feet not quite touching the ground, but it was just, it tasted so good to me. And I think I used to ask her to make it once a week, and it's one of my favorite dishes, and you don't see it anywhere. She's the only person who's ever made it for me. And that's my number one. To me, that's actually kind of what was the impetus for my list. My wife and I were talking about something. We were talking about gnocchi, and dumplings and gnocchi are sort of the same. Sure. They're a different technique. Gnocchi are typically much lighter, but it kind of, that hit home with me. And I knew I had to do the top three at some point coming up. So I was trying to be prepared, but I figured this would be a good way to go about it. But yeah, chicken and dumplings right there at the top for me. Number one.
Dumplings number one. Got it. All right.
So no Manhattans with mine though. I'll try it. No. I'll try it.
I wouldn't necessarily recommend that pairing.
When you're 4 years old in front of your parents, not a good call.
Let's leave it. At least wait till they're looking the other way. All right. So my number two pick, I think my number two pick is going to be a slash. And it kind of comes from another topic that we've talked about before, with my father and his green thumb. So we always had a great garden out front in the front yard. And we talked a little bit about the, you know, my brothers and I would go out and sneak out
at night. Yeah.
And all that stuff. In the backyard, we had a pool that had a fence that ran along it. And along that fence, we had Concord grapes, these grapevines that just grew all along the fence. And then we had a row of cherry tomatoes that were just beyond that. Or just before that, closer to the house. So there's two different things that come with this nostalgia here. The Concord grapes, just eating them. We'd make jams and stuff, but we would just kind of like eat them as we were going.
Yeah.
But we used to have grape fights. So grew up in a house, there was five of us.
Yeah.
Five of us, you know, four boys and then my younger sister.
Perfect size for throwing.
Oh yeah. And you know, all of our clothes would have these little purple pelts, you know, these purple marks all over them.
Love it.
From having grape fights. So you come around the corner, we got, you know, the fences, different hiding spots and the swing set and all that kind of stuff. So we would be able to kind of hide a little bit. You know, I was the middle of five. So, you know, the two older ones picked on me and made sure that the two younger ones got to beat on me. So, you know.
Oh, lovely. You got sandwiched in the middle. Nice.
Yeah, I can't figure out why I'm the way I am these days. So the Concord grapes. And then, I mean, if I taste a Concord grape, it immediately sends me back to those moments where I'd be getting pelted with Concord grapes by the pool or, you know, in the backyard or whatever. So that, you know, that's more of an action kind of thing. But then just beyond that was the cherry tomatoes. So we'd have, I want to say, two dozen cherry tomato plants.
It's a lot of tomatoes, man.
Oh yeah, and we'd have, you know, the regular beefsteak tomatoes and all that stuff up front. We went through a lot. Again, there was a small army we were feeding.
Right, right.
But just those, you know, when they start to blister a little bit and you pick them right off of off of the vine, and still warm from the sun, and you just put a little salt on it, and just pop the whole, and then the whole thing kind of pops in your mouth. So cherry tomatoes and Concord grapes, my number two nostalgia.
Okay, that's a good one. Yep. Does anything taste more like summer than a perfectly ripe tomato? No matter how hard you try, you can't emulate that. That's the only thing.
Yeah. That's it encapsulates summer in one bite.
Yeah. That was good. So my list isn't necessarily in a particular order. Clearly, I told you about the chicken and dumplings. But I'm going to break it up here a little bit. And it'll make sense when I get to the last one. But I feel like a strong finish is important. So the next one is what my mom and I refer to, my parents and I refer to, as Casey casserole.
Casey casserole.
I had this friend Casey who lived in the same neighborhood, and as we were in high school at this point, and the era I grew up, no judgment, people, but a good tuna casserole is hard to beat. But you got to do it right. It is tuna casserole, so it's canned tuna. It's cheese, it's pasta, usually shell pasta. You could use orchiata. My wife and I have kind of elevated it. It's actually quite good, but I really like the dish. So it's like lasagna with tuna fish. And yeah, if that doesn't sound appealing, too bad. It was delicious. But my friend liked it so much. My mom would make a big tray, typical like a baking sheet. And there were just three of us. I'm an only child. So we'd eat a little bit, but he'd come over after school with me and he'd plow through like all but like one corner slice. And every time my mom made it, that's what would happen. And we would never have leftovers. So it became nicknamed Casey Casserole. But I can remember we're just sitting there. He's just spooning it out. And we're talking about whatever the hell we're talking about, surfing, football practice, whatever. And it's just, we would sit there and laugh for like an hour. We're supposed to be doing homework.
Right.
And that's all we were doing. And it's just it's a really good memory. And maybe I think the food tastes better than it did. And probably. But that one, it was like, that was the second dish to my mind. So tuna casserole, my mom did it right. I know people might have a hard time believing that, but it was actually really good. But it's a little bit like your grape and tomato story,
right?
It's more, I think, about the events around it. But he was a really good friend, and it's just those little moments. So I think even when I crack open canned tuna, I'm like, Casey, it's like the first person I think of. So that's my number two.
Perfect. I like it.
That's the one I picked for number two.
All right, so this is my last pick then, so I gotta sort of narrow it down. But
was your second one tuna casserole?
It was not, and also my first one was not chicken and dumplings. So. All right, so I think I'm gonna go, which you know, it's a little bit of a direction that you probably wouldn't think that I would go in, and it's like a different type of nostalgia. So it's really one of the things that got me into cooking. So I'm going to go with frozen fish sticks and french fries.
Oh, well, yeah, every kid's favorite.
Yeah, so.
We got to dive into this a little more, though. How did that get you into cooking? I'm curious.
It got me wanting to experience better cuisine.
Right?
I remember one October, so my birthday's in October, and we had my grandparents over, and my father we were just throwing something together. It was after football practice or football game or whatever it was. And my grandparents were coming over, and my father was like, yeah, I'll just throw some fish sticks and fries in. And I couldn't care less. I was like, yeah, that sounds great. Fish sticks and fries. Sounds like a birthday dinner to me.
I'm stoked. I'm all set.
And I remember my mother being not very happy with my father at the time about, you know, like, how could you serve this to my parents and stuff? And I'm thinking, like, we eat this shit all the time. What are you talking about?
This is delicious. Try putting more ketchup on it, Mom. You're not doing it right.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Tartar sauce? Have you had tartar sauce before? It's pickles and mayonnaise. Come on. Right? So I was perfectly happy with it. I just remember, there was a little hullabaloo about it. But, I mean, yeah, it's not like fish sticks and fries are this amazing cuisine that you're going to – but it's one of those things, like, if I think of my childhood, for some reason, fish sticks and french fries stick out.
That's a good one. That was – well, that it's in my top 10.
All right.
If I had to shift gears, chicken nuggets didn't make it in my top 10 list, just for full disclosure. No, but that's a good one.
That rounds up my top three. So this is, you're going to That's bring us home. Well, here.
You know, that was a nice finish since we went from tuna and casserole to that. It was
right.
You bridged. I like it.
Yeah.
Well, my last one is a little bit like your Manhattan story. This one is related to my grandfather, who was an awfully good cook. He had sourdough starters ever since I can remember. He was an incredible baker, made really great sourdough bread. But, you know, he had Southern. He grew up in the South, raised by Southern parents. So biscuits were a really big deal. And he made really, really good sourdough biscuits. But when I'd go stay with him or when he'd come and stay with us, which was pretty often, he would always make breakfast. Sometimes he'd make sourdough pancakes, which were delicious. But my favorite thing he made was sausage gravy and sourdough biscuits.
Oh, yeah.
And I was a little kid. I could polish off a plate the size of my head and ask for more because I would get to sit there and talk to my grandfather, who I looked up to. And miss him dearly, like we all do with our grandparents. But he was such a good cook. It tasted so good, I couldn't stop eating it. And I just got to talk to him. And it was just, it's one of those moments you can't emulate if you try kind of thing. But that is absolutely top three. And I've made it since. It just doesn't compare. It's not the same experience. And I'm not just saying he was a good cook. He was a really good cook. Because I remember not liking Thanksgiving at all when I was a kid, unless we'd go over to his house.
Right.
He knew how to deep fry turkey. He made amazing oyster stuffing. I mean, the guy could cook. He made pecan pie. Like you want to eat it. Not that garbage you buy at the store, but like, it's good. You know, I'm full, but I'm still eating. You know, that's the kind of cook he was. But he always had great stories. Really funny guy. Incredibly smart. And it was just, I think I just kept, number one, that it tasted really good, but I kept eating so he'd keep talking to me and telling me stories.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the right there, the definition of nostalgia, right? It's not, it's not, you can't recreate those things. You can't go back. No. If you went and you had his sourdough starter still today, if it was still kicking around and you made the exact same recipe and you made it exactly like he made it, it's more than just the taste of the food. It's the ambiance. It's the company that you have around you. And, you know, you can't replace those grandparents' stories.
No, they're great, aren't they? Yeah. I'm lucky I have those memories. I feel very fortunate. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Top three this week.
That's our top three. Good one, Chef. I like your picks. So, yeah, I think the middle one's my favorite. I'll leave it at that.
Oh, yeah. What is that? The cherry tomatoes and...
I love that. That was a great story.
Which don't really go together, but they do just because...
No, I totally get it now. Yeah.
All right. Well, that sort of leads us into Sam Kennedy. So we alluded earlier on to, you know, a little bit of Sam's background and, you know, how we know each other, how Sam and I know each other, how Fred and Sam know each other and the three of us. But we're going to get a little bit more of a deep dive into sort of the cheese world and the thought process behind it and some of the nuances that, you know, you and I wouldn't even think about. And I mean, yeah. I'm a chef. I deal with food all the time. You know, some of those nuances that Sam will get into are, you know, sort of those aha moments that we just talked about. Like, well, that makes sense. You know, we talk about wine and terroir and, you know,
microclimates and all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
Quality of food ingredients and, you know, supporting the local artisans that do things the right way. And
yeah, people working to a higher standard. People are conscious about what they're doing. People are just have a gift. It's a really great interview, folks. Sam's an awfully good cheesemaker, so we should probably let him speak for himself, right?
Yeah, so I guess we'll get right into our interview here with Sam Kennedy. Here we are, Sam Kennedy.
Cheers, enjoy.
All right, everybody, we want to welcome to the show Sam Kennedy. Sam, great friend of mine. Sam was actually, as I mentioned in the intro, one of the first people I met at the Culinary Institute of America. Also, before or after the CIA and before we started working together, Sam was the head cheesemaker at Cherry Grove Farm in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. And then I talked him out of the cheesemaking world. And he came down and was my sous chef for our first year when we opened the Terrace of the Charlotte Inn on Martha's Vineyard. And I guess I scared him out of the food industry for good because he's now been the head cheesemaker at the farm at Doe Run for how many years now, Sam?
Seven, 8 years.
7 years. So I completely scared him out of the restaurant world by by having him work with me for a year. So here we are again, great friend of mine. Sam and I go back to right when we graduated high school. So again, longer than Fred and I have known each other. So welcome to the show, Sam Kennedy. Sam, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here. It's good to see you guys. Haven't seen Justin in, God, 7-8 years now.
Yeah, has it really been that long? You guys haven't seen each other.
On like FaceTime or anything. It's literally been since New Year's Eve. Oh no, I guess it was in January when you left in 2014, right?
Yeah. So Sam, I'm sure you can agree with me. He looks terrible now, doesn't
he? Really, hell's broken. Go.
Is that what fatherhood does? I mean, is this what I get to look forward to?
Yeah, it doesn't get any better from here, trust me. As always, our guest kind of drives the show, drives the topics, what we're talking about here. And it's about time somebody went into the whiskey world, and especially my favorite drink of all time. So, Sam, what do we got for our cocktail so we can have a little cheers here and start drinking?
Yeah, so I went with Manhattan. Manhattan is just a classic cocktail for me. My father introduced it to me when I was, probably underage, but I have a great respect for it as I, came of age and then started working in restaurants and working in the culinary arts field. It's just a really nice one to kind of finish out the day and just to kind of cheers to a good day's work. So,
yeah. Yeah. So Manhattan's, that's my family drink as well. So my grandfather sort of introduced that to my entire family. So we drink Manhattan's all the time, anytime my family gets together. And then, anytime no one's looking, I drink one of those too. So definitely, definitely right up my alley, but not necessarily in Fred's, right up Fred's wheelhouse. Fred's.
Well, hey, wine guys, we're not all bad. We do drink spirits. Manhattan isn't my go-to, but I'm channeling my inner Ron Swanson here. I feel pretty good about it. What's in my glass is brown. So I feel a little more manly now.
It's a
nice drink. I attended bar when I first started out. Oh God, 20 plus years ago, I'll just leave it at that. And it was Rusty Nails, it was Manhattans, it was Old Fashions. And it's funny, those went out of style and now they're back, and really well-crafted classic cocktails are a thing again. So I have an appreciation for them. It's been a while since I've had one. So speaking of that.
Yeah, cheers. Let's have a little cheers here. So I know you can't, you might be able to have a cheers with us during the podcast while you're listening, but we'll have a nice little Manhattan cheers. So welcome to the show.
Yeah, welcome.
Alrighty. Well, we got the most important part of the show done. So
right.
We can just start drinking and call it a day.
Right. Well, Sam, what did you make your Manhattan with? Because the recipe can vary a little bit depending on taste, but what did you put in yours? Obviously it's whiskey, but what's your go-to there?
Yeah, so I always kind of steer towards the rye. I just like the depth of flavor that you get with the rye whiskeys. So I went with the Bullet Rye. It's 95 proof, so a little stronger kick to it. So I do like that as well. I went with, I go red vermouth. So just a sweet red vermouth. And then as well, just some Angostura bitters. I just kind of go classic with it. And then also I pick cherries every year. And so I make my own brandy cherries. Nice. Sana introduced me to. And so I never turned back.
Yeah, cool. If you can get those good cherries, that's good. So a classic Manhattan originally was made with rye. I mean, that's the origin of the drink is with rye. But a lot of times now you see it with, I tend to go bourbon when I make my Manhattans. My grandfather was a Canadian whiskey guy. Any kind of blended whiskeys, anything like that can be made into a Manhattan for sure. And, the ratio of whiskey to vermouth, there's a little bit speculation there, because if you look at in Italy, they make we tend to lean Italian in this podcast because Fred and I have a lot of Italian food and beverage background. They do a 50-50, so 50% vermouth and 50% whiskey. I go more like 95-5. that comes from my grandfather, which we're not gonna get too much into me right now, but he used to pretend that he only had a little splash in there, but then he would like spill it a little more, and he'd add more than what he actually thought he did. So I kind of do that a little bit when I make mine. But yeah, I mean, rye, you get a little more high octane, you get more bang for your buck there when you go rye, for sure.
Exactly. Yeah, I probably fall in the middle. I do about 70, 75-25.
Okay,
for my ratio.
Nice. Yeah, I want a little more Italian. Mine's not quite 50-50. It's like 60-40. And I use Capanna because it's an Italian sweet vermouth. So that's what I threw in mine. Yeah, I had to be that guy. Sorry. It's good.
It's a good one.
Yeah, I'm very rusty, but it came out all right. I'm pretty happy with it.
Right.
The more I drink it, the happier I get, which is a weird thing. Go figure.
Brad, you were talking about rusty nails before. Do you remember how to make a rusty nail?
Well, I know it's got Drambuie and scotch in it, and I feel like I'm leaving something out.
No, all you got to do is leave it in the rain. That's how you make a rusty nail.
That was so bad. Same as every week. Wow.
I didn't see it coming.
I didn't either. I walked right into that one.
Yeah, you sure did.
So, Sam, on that terrible, god-awful segue, you're a cheesemaker. You're the head cheesemaker at Doe Run Farm. Tell us everything, and then let's talk about these two cheeses you sent, because holy cow, pun intended, incredible. So, yeah, give us the lowdown.
Yeah. So I dabbled into cheese before I made it to the terrace, you know, out to Martha's Vineyard. As Justin was saying, at Cherry Grove Farm, I was there for about 5-6 years, you know, just getting, you know, my legs under me, really kind of learning what the hell a dairy cow is, that whole side of it. And then, you know, just, you know, kind of wanted to get back into the food world and then made it back out, you know, back to cheesemaking. I mean, it's kind of in my blood. My grandmother was a cheesemaker up in upstate New York, you know, nothing on the professional end, just on the homestead, you know, kind of just selling to neighbors, you know, just making a buck, really. Back, you know, when they first got into New York State. But yeah, it's, you know, a super interesting craft. I find a lot of enjoyment with it. It's really scientific. It really, you know, I can do what I do every day, and every day I'll learn something new, which is really kind of key to my development, key to my profession, and just, you know, what makes me happy. So it's really interesting, you know, when you start approaching cheese from the culinary mindset. So it's kind of been the best of both worlds. You know, I've taken what Justin's taught me, what we both learned at CIA, and really kind of helped just push the boundaries of cheese in Slovenia, but hopefully in the U.S. So it's been a really, really fun trip so far, that's for sure.
Yeah, so the farm at Doe Run, if you're in the eastern part of Pennsylvania, you probably heard of it, but I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that have not heard of it. So tell us a little bit about the farm itself and where it's located and, you know, where you can buy the cheeses and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so the farm at Doe Run, you know, we're a gentleman's farm out here in southern Chester County. So we have an owner. He always wanted a dairy farm. He always wanted to milk dairy cows. He actually grew up out by where Justin is now, out in the Pittsburgh area, you know, and made his money in the retail clothing world. And then, you know, really was trying to just find a happier style to his life. And so he moved out into the country of Philadelphia, out into Chester County, and developed this farm. So we're milking, you know, milk about 20 to 25 cows any time of the year. And then we also milk sheep and goats as well. So we're kind of the triple threat, so to speak, with as far as farmstead cheese goes. There's really nobody out there that's crazy enough to milk all three herds. There's very few of us. There's, you know, probably one or two on every continent, basically, that are milking all three herds and making cheese with it.
Wow. So it's that rare. That's kind of nuts.
Yeah.
Okay. Makes sense. It's
yeah, you know,
amount of work, but yeah.
And they're very specialized. They're highly specialized, you know, practices in each of their own specialities. So, you know, to milk sheep, it's different than milking a goat, which is different than milking a cow. It's a little easier to milk goat and sheep together just because the equipment is the same size. You know, cow equipment is obviously going to be much bigger. But yeah, so it's, you know, it's really interesting. And then there's just little nuances to it that you really have to kind of learn, especially when working with the milks on a farmstead level, because all our cows and all our animals are grass fed. So that milk really changes seasonally. So from when, you know, we're out just on the first grasses of the year, which the younger St. Malachi you guys got was from that time period. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about 10 months old, so it's still very, very fresh. But the cows, you know, are just out on pasture. So you're talking probably April, May time period for that batch. And then on the older wheel, that's from the fall. So that's, you know, the come down of the milk. For St. Malachi, we really like that shoulder seasoned milk. It's really what is develops good texture. It develops great flavor profile. It's all about the complexity of the grass and then also the water content of that grass. You know, in the East Coast, we've been getting a lot of rain during the summertime, so it kind of washes out the grass and doesn't make for good cheese making. So it's, you know, better for other styles of cheese at that point.
That's fascinating. I didn't know any of that. That was absolutely fascinating. And it makes perfect sense. I mean, they're consuming what creates the milk. And yeah, if it's watered down, it doesn't give you the same result. The shoulder season, I hadn't, yeah, that was an education. Thank you.
Dairy cows, and it's their terroir. It's the same kind of thing we talk about with the cider, with the terroir, with wine, obviously, we talk about that kind of stuff. All of those elements have a lot to do with what the final product is. It's that seasonality and the best products and turning it into, you know, whatever you can. So the St. Malachi itself, tell us a little bit about that cheese, because I know I've worked with this cheese for a while because you've sent it to me. I mean, we haven't seen each other, but every restaurant I've been at and the country club and everywhere, I've made you send it to me so that we were serving it. But this St. Malachi has quite a few awards. And, you know, tell us a little bit about what you got going on with it and where the name came from, too.
Yeah. So St. Malachi is actually named after one of the oldest churches in Southeast Pennsylvania. So it's a little chapel that actually sits up in the top of the valley and kind of overlooks the property. And so, it was an old friendship meeting. So before a lot of the other religions, you know, when we were Puritans in this part of the country, the Quakers, the Puritans, and the friendship meeting, or the Quakers were part of the friendship meeting and the Puritans were kind of the other set of it. But Pennsylvania, of course, is classic Quaker land. So, it's definitely a Quaker church. But then, you know, the cheese is a really, really interesting cheese. It's a washed curd. So we actually are physically washing the curd when it's in, you know, if you just think curd and whey, diluting that mixture just to help develop what we're wanting out of as far as texture and flavor development goes, as well as, you know, calcium content and lactose. So all these little things kind of get diluted when we're adding water to that make process. And that also allows us to get just a little bit more excess of the sugar. So, you know, with St. Malachi, you get that nice sweet note, which you guys will start to kind of see when we start tasting it. You'll see how it develops between the two cheeses. That's really why I wanted to send both ages, because they are so different.
Yeah. Not only the texture,
they are very different.
Yeah, that flavor profile, the texture is way different. And the flavor profile, I mean, for something that's made very similar, obviously with, like you said, different times of year with the milk, but basically it's the same process, just one of them's aged longer, right?
Exactly.
And you get those nice nutty caramel kind of notes to it, to compare it to another cheese. So, you know, St. Malachi, cow's milk cheese, but where would you, what comparable cheese would you say that you would compare it to?
Yeah, so, you know, in the cheese world, we always, you know, it's really kind of like the wine world as well. You know, as Americans, we're always looking to Europe. We're always looking to the old world to try to help define what we do here in the new world. And so if you had to look at the closest counterpart as far as cheese, the actual technology of the cheese, it would be a Gouda, Gouda and an aged Gouda. But then there's also these little techniques that we use during the make process that actually start to push it a little bit more towards what would be called a Goutaler. So it's kind of a mix of a Gouda and an Emmentaler. And then we leave out certain parts and we kind of played with it and toyed with it to get it to be the best of both worlds, especially when it's young versus when it's aged. That's really when we wanted to see that stark difference between the two. You know, so when it's young, it's a little bit more of that Goutaler. When it's aged, it's definitely a lot more of that, you know, just classic from the Netherlands, you know, and then, you know, we got those awards, you know, so we wanted to touch on those. This cheese, St. Malachi is definitely, you know, our highest winning cheese. It's won at the international level at the World Cheese Awards and the World Championship Cheese Contest. It's won at the national level with the American Cheese Society Awards, And then it's also won on the regional level with the State of Pennsylvania Farm Show. So we've won, you know, Best of Show in the PA Farm Show. We've won Best of Show at the American Cheese Society. We won top 20 cheeses in the world at the World Championship Cheese Contest. And then we won the Best Jersey Cow's Milk Cheese in the World at the World Cheese Awards.
That's insane. Wow. Wow. That's incredible. Yeah. You know, we talked about the awards earlier. I was hoping we wouldn't gloss over it, but it's pretty incredible because I'm looking at the package you sent and this one's littered with awards on it. And it's like, what's the cheese again? There's just so many awards. I can hardly read it, but congratulations. That's, I don't think an easy feat for somebody who may have been a cheesemaker since they were a little kid. Now they're in their 60s and they've been doing it for 50 plus years. I mean, you guys are just like about 10 years in. I know you have a culinary background, but that's a hell of an accomplishment. I mean, it's actually kind of mind-blowing because the one thing I've noticed that if people that can be picky are wine people, but I would say cheese people can even go a step further. So congratulations. It's pretty, it's just nuts, really. But you know, hey, before we move too far past it, you know what really struck me about both of them? There was something alpiney to me with the cheeses. Like it maybe Bito might be a little obscure for people, kind of reminiscent of Piave, a touch. And, you know, it just really spoke to me. And it's just like it, when you said Gouda, it kind of hit it right, the nail on the head. And you said Emmentaler. That was one of the first things that popped into my head. So I feel like at least I'm somewhere on semi-firm footing. I was pretty proud of myself. Not that I have anything to do with this, but at least I wasn't too far off the mark. But can you explain the alpine note? Is that the grass? Is that the technique? Is it both coming together?
It's a little bit of both, you know, and that's that Gutaler, that kind of, when we're speaking about the Gutaler, mm-hmm. you know, that cheese kind of walks in both of those worlds. What we leave out of this cheese is we leave out propionic, so we don't get any of that gas that you typically see in an Emmentaler, even in, you know, certain B2s, certain times of the year, they'll get, you know, a little eye development. It's definitely more of a cheese that you're not looking for the eye development when it comes to that specific cheese. But yeah, so we kind of like to walk the line between the two, but it is the grass as well. You know, it's not, there's not as many cheeses out there that are grass fed than there are, you know, from the conventional side. And most of those cheeses typically come from the Alps. So one, you know, right away, that grassy flavor profile is going to bring it back to that area. And it's just because that's where we get most of that flavor profile in our world.
Yeah, they're delicious. Well, you know what? We've got the Manhattan in front of us. We got both of the cheeses. Let's eat and drink a little bit, shall we?
Yeah, I've been going while you two were talking. Yeah,
I've already eaten half a pound of each cheese, so I'm, you know, I'm pretending like this is my first taste.
Right, right. But yeah, the you know, when you think about pairing cheeses, the first thing that comes to a lot of people's mind is wine, right? I mean, you know, you think about wine and cheese is one of the most classic pairings that you could possibly have. Sam and myself coming from the chef world, where alcoholism is fairly prevalent, we want to get from point A to point B as quickly as possible. So we end up going the spirit route. And, you know, the Manhattans, obviously, we talked about, you know, that being kind of our drink of choice. But it's not just that. I mean, the pairing with a Manhattan, you know, whiskey based beverage and these eight, especially the aged one, I feel like the reserve with the Manhattan, because you get, I mean, you get that little crystallization with the, you know, the texture of it. Obviously you get those caramel notes, which are similar to the, in my case, bourbon, but also, you know, with rye and, you know, just that kind of, that pairing just works, you know. It's just, it's such a nice, in fact, I'm going to drink to it. Well,
well, it's interesting you bring that up, Chef, because it's like, to me, when you have the Manhattan with the reserve, it's like the reserve becomes more savory. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have those notes that that almost like, not sweet like butterscotch, but kind of reminiscent of that. And you get that beautiful crystalline texture, but it's not aggressive, which is what I really like about it. But then there's just this bloom of like, and like really nice tangy savory. It's absolutely delicious. And I don't normally do a spirit as a pairing. You know, I might have something with it, but it's sort of by chance, not as like a focus. And I think there was a write-up on this, I think the Malachi, when you got like your first giant award from the Cheese Connoisseur, and you mentioned bourbon as being one of your favorite pairings for this, or kind of your go-to? You said whiskey, but you said bourbon you really liked a lot. So yeah, this is lovely. Yeah, really good call.
Yeah, and it's really, you know, just not a lot will stand up to it. You know, you have to go really bold red, and you're almost going to outbeat the St. Malachi at that point. And so you really have a tough time with finding something that's going to stand up to it and just not be completely overwhelmed by the St. Malachi. I mean, because it's really just such a bold cheese, especially when it's aged. I mean, that flavor profile is so robust, so unctuous and creamy, and you know, and you just kind of get to this point with it where it's completely overwhelming your palate, but you want to keep going in for more. Right. And so you need something that's really going to stand up to it. And, you know, then you start getting, you know, you don't think that you find vanilla notes in a cheese, but then all of a sudden when you start pairing it with a really nice aged bourbon, and you pull vanillin out of it almost immediately, and you start getting, you know, a little bit more of the barrel out of the bourbon, which you don't really tend to find too much in bourbons. So it's really interesting when you can start just getting some of those nuances, even though you have these big, bold flavor profiles that you're working with.
Yeah, you know, I would, if I was in the wine, if I was trying to pair the St. Malachi with a wine, I would probably go the other way and go like a sparkling, like a Prosecco.
Thank you. Or I was going to say bubbles. Something. The texture gives you more versatility.
Yeah, so I think rather than go on the big red, which, you know, because you're trying to like fight bold with bold.
You're matching it. Yeah, fire with fire.
In the other direction, it would actually, you know, if you go like a nice crisp champagne or a nice dry Prosecco, that would complement the flavors much more. And I also think a beer would be fantastic with this. I
mean, oh, no kidding.
You know, a nice IPA, which I know I tend to lean heavy on the IPAs, but
you know, they make other beers besides IPA.
Yeah, but I mean, we'll talk about that another show, but
well, hey, since we've got the man who makes the cheese, if you were going to pair a beer with it, what would be your call? What would you like?
Would the same Malachi and beer, I'd probably start running, you know, if I wanted something that's going to add some complexity to it, I might go with, you know, something like the, you know, some of the new sours that are coming out, not the heavy fruited sours, but just some of those like farmhouse saisons. You might find that good texture with the bubble. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, again, you know, I'm an IPA guy myself.
Fred, you're talking about the wrong tree. You're trying to
get I'm outnumbered. All right, I'll just sit over here in the corner and keep drinking. I can do that.
Sam and I spent a lot of time together in culinary school, and then spent a lot of time together after culinary school. Mm-hmm. And we drank a lot of IPAs, and we drank a lot of Manhattans together. Yeah, definitely went down that avenue, went down that culinary road many times.
Right, not too much Prosecco.
No. We did have some Westport Rivers bubbly a couple of times though. So.
But you know, and it's really kind of, it's also one of those things, like I also try to tend towards like the natural wines right now. And it's really from, you know, when I met Fred with, you know, some of the wines that he was bringing in. And I was just so curious about that farmhouse note and just how delicate it could be, but how missed it was in my flavor profile for wine. And so I've been trying to find, you know, those bottles ever since, ever since our first meeting, Fred. So it's really interesting. Yeah. That one moment in time really starts to send you down a completely new road and new direction and, you know, kind of new pursuit of happiness. So,
yeah, it's funny what, you know, resonates with you, isn't it? You know, there's these moments we all have and it just sticks with you kind of. And it's funny, you mentioned the wine, you remember the label, and I don't think I've talked about that wine in a good maybe 5 or 6 years, but yeah, you have that kind of, in a very nice way, the Italians refer to it as animale, but it has that kind of like barnyard kind of quality to it. Not that it smells like horse manure or anything like that, but it has this extra uber umami kind of thing going on, and it's really hard to put your finger on it. And man, when it's done right, it's glorious. It's just another dimension to it. Yeah, and you're always kind of chasing that. Yeah,
it's that like earthy note, but yeah. You know, that, like you said, umami, you know, in the wine world, we talk about that barnyard flavor, but it's like a whole different flavor profile, right? And it's,
yeah, but the French have a term for it. Didn't David, we had a guest on before, what is it? Sapidite, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Kind of that.
Yeah, one of those French terms, right?
Quality. Yeah. Right. Well, that's the best I can do. Sorry.
Yeah.
Parlo italiano un po'.
Sam, there's a couple things I want to go over before we start wrapping up here, but one of them being, where can people buy your cheeses?
You know, it really depends on what part of the country you're in. I can kind of go regionally. You know, we like to sell to small cheese shops, so you won't find us in, the Whole Foods or the Wegmans or the larger shops. In New York City, the biggest one we sell to is Murray's, but it's because they do a great job of getting our cheese into the restaurants of New York City. And that's a whole nother side of the business that would take up that much time just trying to get in with those guys. I mean, that was pre-COVID. So post-COVID is a little bit different.
Right.
During COVID, I should say. Up by Fred, probably the closest would be like in to Boston. You'd find it at like Formaggio Kitchen.
Or Eason, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. There's also some smaller shops that have come up in the Boston region. You know, Pittsburgh, we've definitely got a few shops out there. East End Co-op. Then there's a small cheese shop called Chantel's. It's really, really nice owners. This husband wife couple out there that are really doing some good things in the cheese world. Philadelphia, you got the Bruno Brothers. Again, a lot of the smaller co-ops. Swarthmore Co-op, 320 Market, and then we kind of pick and choose all around the country. You know, we'll have, one or two shops out in Chicago, one or two down in like the Nashville, South Carolina, kind of mix in the area. And so we really just want to deal with people that are going to respect the product. You know, we want to deal with somebody that's going to get our story out there, present it well. Because what we realize is that, if somebody has a really bad piece of cheese, it's a direct reflection of the cheesemaker, right. Even though most of the time that's got to do with handling at the retail level. I send out great cheese. It goes bad when it's, sitting in the wrong light, sitting in the wrong packaging, so we really like to be selective with who we sell to. And then the other side of what we've been balancing during this whole COVID experience is, with my background in the restaurant world, I like to sell to Justin. That's my choice person I want to sell to. I want to make cheese that is going to be respected by the chefs, the great chefs of the world, and really be used in ways that I won't think about. And, put on plates in ways that I won't think about and that I don't have the time to think about. And then, just really kind of want to, that's kind of like really what I like about cheesemaking right now is, just kind of being that cheesemaker for the chef world. I want to do design for cheeses. I want to help, chefs get more cheese on their menus, get more cheese in people's mouths. And that's really kind of my goal at the end of the day. So it's really been it's been fun, but yeah, it's tough. We're kind of, I like to be the unicorn,
Right.
Unicorn of that cheese world.
Yeah, it's a tough balance, right?
It's definitely worked out well for me because I've carried your cheeses, which actually brings me to the point of you got to send me some cheeses over to Spello so we can start putting up the menu over there.
Of course.
And I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about Culinary Harvest.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a cool, interesting new project with actually a good friend of Justin and I's, Carlo Luciano, went to school with us. Carlo was working his magic in the pizza world and in the large scale pizza world. He was working in a lot of the outdoor venues up and down the East Coast selling pizza, and then COVID hit, and so we're touching base every few months pre-COVID. And then, once COVID hit, I kind of had this realization that, his business must be really hurting because my business was hurting. And what we were doing was, trying to be progressive and to be aware of what the realities of our world were becoming. Restaurants were going away. Again, we were just talking about how, I like selling 85% of my product to restaurants, and all of a sudden that floor went away. And so whole new experience for us. And so, I sat down with Carlo and I really, we decided that we wanted to try to create something that would help promote small business, help promote local business, and then hopefully eventually, you know, help small restaurants. We know we're not going to be the saviors of the restaurant world, but if we can help in any way we can, then that's what we want to do. And so that's kind of the background, the Culinary Harvest. And then, you know, through all of this, it's now become basically an online farmer's market. And so we sell curbside. We don't have a brick and mortar. We work out of a small co-op space that, you know, we just, you know, got everything together and, you know, got the space together, got it inspected and certified. And now we're pumping, you know, bringing food in and getting it right out the door that day. So we're trying to just be, you know, a quick turnover process that keeps everything local.
Yeah. So basically the idea is that it bring in a bunch of local products. It's a membership only. People order whatever they want online. It's a 1-day pickup. So it's really for people in, you know, in Eastern Pennsylvania and Southeast Pennsylvania, right, to be specific. So it's a membership only kind of idea, but the whole thing is just promoting all the small local businesses and the artisans and the people who are treating the products great. And a lot of the stuff that Fred and I talk about on Culinary Road all the time, that, you know, getting those local, finding those local people that are making gems of products. But you guys have done it all together and you're bringing them all together and giving it straight to the consumer, which is, you know, a great idea. And, you know, it's just really in its infancy at this point, really just starting to come along. We'll have Carlo on down the road a little while.
We have to. If the man makes pizza, we're having Carlo on the where he's doing it. Yeah.
Carlo will be a good.
Just tell him to be ready, Sam. He's coming on.
Again, Culinary Harvest is for another show. I just wanted to mention it briefly here because it's kind of a new project that I know you're involved with. And obviously, Carlo's a great friend of mine. And, you know, I want to make sure I'm promoting you guys the best I can. But besides promoting Culinary Harvest, I also want to make sure that we're throwing out the Instagram handles that you have here. So your Instagram handles, you sent me 3 of them. So I'm going to go ahead and just throw them all out there. At @cheesemaker_SamKennedy.
That's my personal.
That's your personal one, right? And then we have @PA Cheese Guild.
The local cheese guild. So that's all of Pennsylvania. But, you know, I figured that that'd be a good one just so everybody can kind of see what local, you know, what local products are coming out of Pennsylvania and just kind of get excited. And, you know, there's always those local guilds. You know, if you want a butcher, there's a local butcher guild. You know, you want, there's wine guilds, there's cheese guilds. So there's kind of any, you know, any handcrafted food item, but then also handcrafted products usually have a guild. So it's always a good place to start.
Yeah. Sam's always been sort of a pioneer of finding the local artisans, local producers and making those great relationships, which I had the benefit of piggybacking on that when we were on Martha's Vineyard. We were able to make some really great relationships with some of the local farmers, thanks to Sam's reaching out to them. And, you know, I think this Pennsylvania Cheese Guild is a great starting point. And any of those guilds that you just mentioned, for sure. And then lastly, we have the Farm at Dough Run. So the Instagram handle for that is just @thefarmatdoughrun. And you know, can find all the latest cheeses and all the different, you guys post a lot of cute little pictures of animals. And
I know so many like beautiful little goats and it's just adorable. I was on it for an hour and a half today. I had work to do and I just kind of spaced out. It was great. Yeah.
definitely make sure you follow the Farm at Dough Run. Can people order direct from the farm and have it shipped to their house, or do they have to find these little producers or these little cheese shops?
Yeah, get on that unicorn, that whole unicorn concept. Search for it, you know. So yeah, you gotta go to the cheese shop. You gotta go make friends with your local cheesemonger. We had a great chef in college that taught us, you know, Chef Zierfoss. He always taught us that, you know, if you want a product in your local shop, just ask. If you ask for it, they'll bring it in. If I ask to bring it into their shop, they make me send samples. They, you know, there's this whole back and forth where I'm, you know, basically courting my product onto their shelves, where if they have a market, they'll get it in. So if they don't have it, you know, tell them about it and we'll get it to them. That's for sure. We have the supply.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. Julia Childs is famous for when she had her cooking show back in the late 60s, early 70s, she always had dishes with leeks in them. And people are like, where do I find a leek? And she's like, go to the grocery store and ask them for them. Now you go into every grocery store and they're there. I know that's not your aim, but that the point is, if you ask, people can reach out and hopefully they can contact you and maybe it works for them. Because guys, anybody who's listening, you absolutely want some of this. I feel pretty special. I'm an only child, so I'm not sharing mine, although my wife got a little bit. But you definitely want to seek this out if you can. It's absolutely delicious. You've got the awards, but I'm going to give you a hand clap anyway, because it's awfully good. And the Manhattan pairing, spot on, brother. This was really nice. A joy and a really completely different experience for me than what I normally have. So, but I am going to have a sparkling wine with you with this. I think I can change your mind, I think. We'll do that another day when COVID's behind us.
We can always make Sam send us more cheese, and you can send us some wine, Fred, and then we can just do a Zoom meeting. We don't even have to record it. We can just...
All right, consider it done. We'd love to.
I can do the outtakes.
Right?
But again, you know, it was a pleasure having you on, Sam. It's always great to catch up. It's been way too long. We got to make sure we, first of all, catch up more frequently, and second of all, we got to get your cheeses over to Spello as soon as possible. But make sure you do follow Sam on Instagram at cheesemaker_SamKennedy. Also at the farm at Dough Run, and then at PA Cheese Guild. Make sure you're following all three of those for sure. You'll find some good stuff on there. And as always, try to support your local artisans. You know, find the local people that are doing things the right way, and you know, give them the love, give them the support. You know, if you're not in Eastern Pennsylvania, find your Sam Kennedy in you know, in Michigan or wherever. There's only one Sam Kennedy, but you know, there's people that are striving to be as good as a cheesemaker as you are. So you know, go get out and try to find those people for sure.
Yeah, good advice. Very good advice. I think, Sam, we should probably let you get back to your evening. We've cut into it enough. I'm sure you probably have to get up pretty damn early every morning. So we'll cut you free for the night. It was an absolute joy and pleasure talking to you. Thank you for taking the time. Don't think this will be the last time you're on, as long as people listen to us anyway.
Right.
But it was an absolute joy, so thank you.
And especially because you spent on cheese. So.
I could be the cheese part of all any of these that you want to do. I'll be the cheese hand.
All right, awesome. Perfect.
Awesome.
Yeah, you just signed a contract, my friend.
Awesome. Got it recorded. It's recorded.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again, Sam. Great to see you, and we'll look forward to talking to you soon. Cheers.
All right. Ciao.
Okay, that was our interview with Sam Kennedy. Sam, again, is a great friend of mine. Him and I go way back. And, you know, as we talked about earlier, Fred, Sam, and I also go back to our little brief stint there on Martha's Vineyard. But, you know, pretty cool talking to an expert in the cheese world and getting a little behind the scenes. I mean, there's a lot that goes into it. Just like there's a lot that goes into wine and cooking and anything else. It's there's a lot of... I mean, we talk about what season the grass is being eaten by the cows that are then being milked. I mean, those nuances, those are things that as a chef sense. Even don't think about, never mind the general public or, you know, the wine guy.
Right. But when you think of it, it makes sense when he says it out loud.
Sure.
Like, of course. But then until somebody says it, you're kind of, you have no idea.
Right.
But to me, that was fascinating. But I mean, it makes perfect sense. It's the diet. The animal creates the milk. Its diet's going to heavily influence that. It was just it was a really cool point he brought up. And I also really liked that he mentioned, because of his culinary background, you guys went to the CIA together, Culinary Institute of America, so nobody gets confused.
Yeah, not a special agent.
But he, you know, it was funny that, not funny, it was very interesting that he brought up that, you know, that his culinary background really helped him become a better cheesemaker. And now he sees things differently. And it's almost like... he's cooking, but he's not cooking, you know, if that makes any sense. It was just it was a great perspective. And my God, his cheese is so good.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to trying the sheep's milk and the goat. And I was so tempted to ask him about a tre latte, but I figured I might be pushing it.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to bring it up with him at some point. If I can try to get him to make
like a Robiola,
a tre latte Robiola. Cause he makes some, younger cheeses too, some soft rind cheeses and things like that are, you know, it's not just the aged St. Malachi's and things. He runs the full spectrum. He's got, you know, if you look at, you know, we mentioned his handle, Cheesemaker Sam Kennedy, Cheesemaker_Sam Kennedy. You know, check that out. He's, and then obviously the farm at Doe Run, they, all the cheeses are on there. And his wife, Stacy, who actually worked for me at the Terrace, and you met her a couple of times too, when you came down and helped us out. She does all of the social media and stuff for them too. So she's very involved with that side of it.
Really,
and she's
great at taking pictures of baby goats.
Yes.
Click on that. You're just kind of like, wow, that's adorable. Then
another,
like,
baby goat.
Yep. Always a baby goat. That's how they get you.
Yeah. And I, there was a little bit of a mention of, me looking older because I'm a father now.
I was being a wise ass. That was just me being a dork.
Well, that was, but that, you know, Sam kind of alluded to, is that what my future has to hold? Because that was a little something that, you know, Sam and Stacy are expecting a baby here coming up pretty soon, which is, you know, very exciting. You know, they were around when Amelia, my now 9, almost 10-year-old, was little. She was one, just turned one when we all worked together. So, you know, they saw firsthand what it's like at that age. So they're gonna get it a little harder here pretty soon.
It's like a time warp, isn't it? And you can laugh and enjoy the whole show because you've already lived it.
Right, exactly.
He thinks he's busy now. Hang on, buddy.
And we did talk a little bit about the Culinary Harvest, which, again, that's for another show. But that's, again, a great friend of mine, Carlo Luciano, with the Culinary Harvest. But the whole idea, which is why I wanted to bring that up with Sam, because Sam's a partner in that business. But the whole idea of just finding those local artisans and supporting the local people that are doing, which we've talked about in every episode, essentially.
I'm pretty sure we have, yeah.
But, you know, finding the local people that are doing things the right way, not just the local people that are doing things, but the local people that are doing things the right way and are making great product and are supporting, you know, the local businesses, you know.
Yeah, well, he mentioned it's sort of a CSA, but it includes a lot of different things. I think sometimes people think of CSA as just maybe just being produce, but that could be fish, for instance. That could clearly be butchered. It could be meat, cheese, all kinds of products, honey, things of that nature. So
they even do flowers. They do fresh cut flowers. Oh, yeah. Like, right? That. Yeah.
It's if you can find one close to you, folks, wherever you happen to live, and I guarantee you there's at least a couple, go explore it, because it's really kind of cool, and it changes your whole mind about how you cook, what you cook, that you look at seasonality in a really new way. And it almost puts this pressure on you. Then all of a sudden you learn to live with it, and it's great. You know, I don't always need kale on the plate, but I kind of learned how to live with it and work with it. But, you know, it goes beyond that. And, you know, considering how tricky things are for everybody right now, the more you can keep your dollar locally, the better it is for all of us. It's not a public service announcement I'm throwing out there, but it's something to consider and definitely consider supporting.
We always tend to lean in that direction when we talk on these, because the people we have the same sort of passions that we have. Mm-hmm. For, you know, the products that they're dealing with, whether they're, you know, for me cooking it, or you, you know, selling great wines, and, you know, Sam making great cheese, you know, there's a passion that's involved there. And then if you can find those local people that have those same types of passions, those are the people you should piggyback on and really support.
Agreed. Yeah, agreed.
So speaking of piggybacking and supporting, make sure you continue to support us. So follow on Instagram at culinary.rd, Culinary Road. That's sort of where we'll be announcing the next podcast as it comes out every Tuesday.
Upcoming.
So make sure you're following us on there. And then Fred has his at FMIV, which we talk about every show, Fred Mullins IV. And then he always has this little smirk when I do that. And then at Chef Melnick is my personal Instagram as well. So make sure you follow us on all three of those. And then Fred has his amazing YouTube channel, which we talk a lot about food and wine in this podcast. Fred nails the food and wine combos on there, and it's the visual part of it as well. So it's, the YouTube channel is Until Next Wine. Make sure you subscribe to that YouTube channel. And as always, you can leave us messages if you go to anchor.fm/culinaryrd. There's a tab there. You can just click on message, send us a voicemail, your ideas, feedback, things you want us to talk about, ideas for guests we might want to have in the future, whatever you want. send us a message. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, let's talk food and wine, folks. Seriously, it's what we're doing. Or food and wine, excuse me, food and drink. I always do that.
Yeah, food and beverage, food and drink, food and wine, food and cocktails today.
Whatever.
Cheese and whiskey, whatever it is. But you can find, you know, obviously make sure wherever you're listening to us, if it's Spotify, Apple Podcasts, through Anchor, make sure you're rating, subscribing, following, commenting. You know, we want to hear the feedback. We want to make sure that we're hitting all the points that you want us to talk about. So Fred, before we wrap up, anything else you want to add?
No, just if you can, you know, share when you get this podcast, you like it, share it with people you know. Subscribe. I think you've touched on that a bunch, but you know, again, focus on if you can find some great local artisans in the food, the drink world, check them out. I think it's worth it. And I think that's all I got for this time. Perfect. By the way, Manhattans and cheese, nice pairing.
Yeah, doesn't suck.
That's how I'm signing off.
Sounds good. Well, I'll sign off with you too. So we'll see everyone next week. Look for our podcast on Tuesday morning. We'll see you then.
Ciao.